we are, what I'd like to do is introduce Tamara Cook from the Division of Legislative Legal Services to the committee. Tamara has been given the assignment to take us in on the finishing stretch of the bill and has been assigned our personal bill writer and reviser and all of that. Tamara has been involved in writing extensive legislation from the Legislative Legal Services Division, and we welcome you, Tamara, to the committee. This is a working committee. Bob Link with the Department of Administration is with us again. Bob, chirp up anytime that you so desire. Why don't you and Elizabeth begin, Tam, going over the draft 2 of the bill? You have your list of changes here, and just kind of tell us what you have done. And then when we go public, when the villages come on at 1:30, what I'll do is I'll make a formal introduction of the meeting. I will introduce each of you. If each of you would like to say a couple of sentences, I think you should, if you feel like you want to. No, you don't want to? Would you like to,
sure.
Senator? Okay. Mr. Attorney General, would you like to?
I don't know, just if I feel called upon, I'll waive or something.
Okay. Well, I'd like to give you that opportunity. And then we'll just take public testimony if it's out there. Otherwise, we're just going to keep working on with the bill. The mayor invited us to come here today, and again, it's the way I feel is there's no difference coming to Barrow as going to Kenai. It's part of the state, and I just feel it's our job to reach out to as many folks as possible on this issue. Okay.
I am going to go through the first 5 articles, second section, first 5 articles. I will be referring to where the origin of the information came from. The Model Procurement Code is responsible for a lot of the bill. As you all will recall, this has been adopted by 11 states, the Model Procurement Code, and it is intended to be used as a model, not adopted in its entirety. So, and I might just say Bob Link, Marcia Hubbard, Jim Baldwin, and Tamara Cook have just been very instrumental in the last 2 weeks in coming up with this draft too. Tam has prepared the memorandum which itemizes the changes that appear between Draft 1 and Draft 2.
If I can interrupt, Elizabeth, too, we've eliminated the architects and the engineers from this draft. They are not in here. They are in the model code, but they are not here. And the reason they aren't here is I made an administrative decision, and if you all want to overrule that, it's fine with me. But the architects and engineers want to pass what's called the Minnie Brooks Bill, in which they are exempt from direct bidding for their professional services and go out through a negotiation type concept. It was starting to get very, very controversial, and one of the senators have the Minnie Brooks bill in the Senate Finance Committee all by itself. It's gone through Labor and Commerce, it's gone through CNRA, it's had lots of revisions, and I felt like rolling that, putting in Section 5 of the Model Code would have been pulling a bill from committee and also would have been taking a lot of work that 2 committees had done and rolling it into this one, and it would have been a little differently. The architects and engineers are upset. They want it in the bill. They want to have that exemption from competitive bidding. So it is very controversial. So right now in this draft, they're out, and their desires will go through the normal legislative process. Any comments about that?
I agree with you. I think if you combine them, you run the risk of a substantial attack against an ethics bill, which prohibits competitive bidding in one area, a major area of state practices.
But they are wild, just wild, and very concerned. Okay, Elizabeth.
Okay. Just a note on that. I've collected a lot of information on the A&Es and the negotiation versus the competitive bid process. Maryland just changed back after 11 years. That information will be provided to the members of Senate Finance for the hearing and anyone else that's interested in reviewing that information. Okay. Section 1 deals with the purpose statement. Overall, I think that it can be said that the purpose of this bill is to provide a uniform...
Chairperson, I was slightly distracted when Ms. Hickerson stated... Did you state that you had a condensation of the Maryland A&Es?
I have gathered information from Maryland as well as other states on their A&E procedures.
I see you just have it in a packet. Or
yeah.
File. Okay.
It's going to be available prior to the finance hearing and will be available for that hearing and for any members of that committee and anyone else that would like a copy.
In order to pacify the A&Es a little bit, and the senator involved, the Finance Committee is going to hold a public hearing on that bill. What's the bill number? I don't remember. It's Sturdzielewski's bill. Something like that.
I'd like to discuss later, not in this context, many of the things that have taken place in Maryland over many, many years and led to some unsavory, from a public perspective, unsavory activities that have gone on there. So I'd be very wary. Maybe it's a new and model and improved situation.
Okay,
it's a historic fact.
See, I have some real problems with it, just some real problems with it, but the the lobbying effort that they plan to put on and have put on is very strong.
Isn't the present form of the bill, the Sturdzielewski bill, doesn't that have a mini Brooks provision in it?
Yes.
That's been, it's been tailored to provide in certain circumstances that competitive building using price as a factor is appropriate.
Well, they're talking about three pre-qualified individuals and then in between them or something like that.
Yeah, essentially people who are generally equivalent in experience and background and what have you, and then the cost of delivery of those services may become a relevant factor.
That's
going to bid.
That's how it's been modified, really.
And that's a modification of the Minnie Brooks bill that I understand is acceptable to many architects.
That piece of paper for you.
Sure.
So, but they're still upset.
They're upset that we don't have it in here.
They're not exactly happy with the bill, the form that's in now. I know they were not happy when we left CNRA because we took out the municipalities. And they didn't want to have cost in there anyplace.
That's right.
And we left it in as one of the considerations. And I don't know what has happened in labor and commerce to it, but I know that it was that way when I left the communication.
Okay. The new part of section one is element 9, is section 9. So if no one has any trouble with that, that's a request of the Department of Administration just to show the support for that particular section, and I have no objections with it if no one else does. Page 2, section 9 at the top, line 1.
And also on number 8, which permits the continuing development of state procurement practices and policies. That was in the model procurement code. It was left out of draft 1.
Tam? Excuse me. This may not be the appropriate time, but I do have a question about what is being accomplished under paragraph 9. Is it eliminating discrimination in state contracting when the state has been the discriminating person, the person doing the discrimination, or is there some kind of an effort to get at the people's behavior who are going to be potential contractors? I've never been quite sure what this section does,
actually. Bob, can you explain Marsha's rationale or your rationale?
Well, I think it's just, we take the whole purpose. One of the things that the consultant from Arizona suggested was the purpose of the court, even though it would vanish from the law, in case of cases which came up in the future, people would look to the purpose. And one of the reasons for addressing number 9 is probably to address both, rather than just a specific thing. But to use that, and also step with that same language shows up a little later in the bill.
Well, my concern is that if, because it is carried on into substantive law in 050, the same language, my concern is that if the idea is that it's supposed to give the state a method of rejecting a low bid because the bidder is discriminating, is it specific enough to do that? That's my concern. Is that what this is supposed to do? Give you a chance to reject a low bid, for example, because you've got a bidder who's discriminating on the basis of marital status? Or is this just to keep you guys from discriminating against an all-woman contracting firm? Is it the state's discrimination you're trying to curb, or is it discrimination of the providers you're trying to curb? Because if it's discrimination of the providers, I think you need to say more in the law.
Yeah. What we're trying to get is just the general area of reducing any kind of discrimination in the state's procurement. I think we agree with you that there might have to be something further if we went beyond that. Right now, all we do is have the enforcement that somebody has to provide by the Equal Rights Act, and I think that's about it. But it's to go out and say, okay, we can make regulations in this area for our purchasing and for the
Okay, but do you think that the language is going to give you enough authority so that you can make regulations saying if we get a low bidder from a guy who does not hire people with children, that we can reject that bid? I mean, is that the kind of authority you want? And if so, I don't think this is tight enough to grant it.
I don't think that's what we were looking for.
Okay. That was my only concern because the request for the change came across and I never understood the context.
Yeah. No, I think it was less specific than that.
Natasha made the comment to me regarding this, that she just wanted to be able to put into the regs some emphasis for minorities, women, other people that have had difficulty accessing the state contracting system through perhaps training, seminars, or what have you. That's pretty vague, and we wouldn't know until the regs came out. It is in the purpose statement, though, and it is not, it doesn't carry anything more right now than what the regs carry.
Well, it gives them the chance to do the regs, but my concern is that if administration is trying to adopt regs with teeth in them that say, look, if you discriminate, we're not going to have to give you the contract, even though other provisions of the law say that we do, then I don't know if this language is tight enough. And if you're not going to take that step, then what are you accomplishing with this, I suppose, is another question. But
do you do anything by adding a purpose? I mean, if the Act doesn't do things or provide regulations that, in fact, do this, accomplish this purpose, then the purpose is meaningless.
What they do on page 5.
But Senator, what they've done is they've given the commissioner the authority to establish regulations that somehow or other prevent this type of discrimination. But my concern is that where you've got a statute that says the bid goes to the low bidder, can you by regulation say it doesn't if the bidder discriminates? And so if that's what they're trying to do, I'm concerned that the statute may not be achieving that.
Well,
but if that's not what they're trying to do, then it's probably fine.
How does an agency, which is basically told to take a low bid, how does it act when it's encouraged to take aggressive steps to overcome the effects of past discrimination?
And past discrimination on the part of who? Is it the agency that's been doing the discriminating, or is it some guy out there that does the roofing that's been doing the discriminating? I mean, who it is they're supposed to come down on is a question in my mind.
Well, how do they come down? I mean, they have to come down with regulation. The only thing that anybody cares about is, do I get the bid or don't I?
Yeah,
I think, if they get the bid, they don't care.
I think all that they're concerned about is being able, if we wanted to do it as an MBE-type program, a minority business enterprise-type program, where you go out perhaps and solicit, try and find firms, say minority firms, and get them on our qualified bidders list, make sure that they're on, or disadvantaged business, any kind of a disadvantaged business. We don't think that we've got enough power here to do a set-aside. I don't think we try to do a set-aside with what we've got here. But it's more or less MBE was what was mentioned to me by Commissioner Andrews. But we wanted a sufficiently broad enough statement here that a lot of different alternatives could be experimented with, and that's all. I don't think they have in their mind.
But none of those reach the level of saying, take something other than low bid.
No, none of them do that.
To be safe, do we need to eliminate the last compound part of that sentence after the word and on line 3, and encourage agencies to take aggressive steps to overcome the effects of past discrimination, delete that section?
That's me then. I mean, could open it up to some really financial responsibilities, isn't it? I mean, you're going to go have someone go back through all of the contracts to see if there was past discrimination, and if so, then how are you going to remedy the fact that there was or something, isn't it?
Well, my problem is even more basic with it. I don't know whether those agencies have to take steps to overcome the effects of discrimination that they have perpetrated, or whether they're supposed to go out and keep all of the people that they've done business with from discriminating.
Yeah, and how far back do they go to see that, you know, the effects of past discrimination, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's past discrimination? Is that five months or five years?
Or you can read it to say that this is a statement that past discrimination does exist as a matter of fact, and therefore...
Would it make the committee more comfortable if we deleted that last part of the compound sentence, or should we leave it in?
What's it give you, Jim?
Well, actually, all we want is the ability to adopt some regulations that would establish our own MBE program, I think, from the Department of Administration standpoint. Right now, it's been moved, that function's been moved around between Commerce and DOT, and Commerce and DOT, and I think admin wants to, at least on their commodities contracts and that area, want to be able to do some, I don't want to say affirmative action, but Commissioner Andrews wants to get her foot in the door so that she could have some power to do that if she wanted to.
If we give it to her, can we take it away from somebody else?
I don't know that it's actually conferred on anybody else other than, I think it's been done.
The feds did it to DACA, though, didn't they?
I think Commerce has a statute that sort of mentions MBE, but that's about all it does. Mostly it's been done by just passing appropriations in the budget, appropriation goes to DOT for MBE, and the contract is administered out of DOT, or else it goes to Commerce the next year. And I think there was some, at one time there was some dissatisfaction with the way Commerce was doing it, so then it went to DOT the next year, or vice versa. I can't remember.
Do you have to have those, that last phrase?
No, I think this language, I think it can go.
Okay, let's delete.
The first sentence gives what we need.
Okay, put a period after the word parenthood and delete and to discrimination lines 3-4. Okay, let's moving right along.
Article 1 provides, and we put in this section 3630005, which is just a statement of the centralization of the authority. This is out of the Model Procurement Code and was suggested to be included so that there would be no doubt what we're talking about. Section 2, or the next section under executive branch, was there a comment? Did you have a comment?
No, it was a verb.
Oh.
I don't apparently have the most up-to-date comment.
Is this?
11185.
I got that this morning, too.
Mine's a little bit off from what you found. I put out two of
okay. Backing up, just adding one comment under centralization of procurement authority. All is transferred to the commissioner of DOA and the central procurement officer. This is going to change the situation that presently exists with DOT for construction, also with the university, because the university is under the definition of agency.
Yes, I'm wondering if there, after commissioner, you needed to have, though, of administration or something there on line 14. Because when I first read it, you know, it sort of left me up in the air because we have a number of commissioners. And I know later on and in the definition it does, but and later on you talk about the commissioner of administration, but I didn't know it. Maybe we should just
add. If I may, as a stylistic matter, where you have a defined word, we try just to use the word that's defined. But the reason that in another section you notice the word commissioner of administration is because in that same section there's a reference to the commissioner of transportation. Or where there's two commissioners we're talking about, I feel that it's so hopelessly confusing that I went ahead and put in the word commissioner of administration there, rather than saying the commissioner shall approach the commissioner of transportation. So that's terribly confusing.
So what you're saying, but the particular section now defines
commissioner is defined. Then the only reason I would go ahead and be redundant and stick in the definition, the defined term, is where another commissioner is referred to in the same paragraph.
That's good writing. Good legal writing. Okay.
Under the 0.0110 executive branch agencies, there is a change here that says the commissioner shall appoint to the partially exempt services the central procurement officer of the state. This person has to have at least 5 years of prior experience in public procurement and may be removed by the commissioner only for cause. The reason this and the term of office expires with the governor. The reason that the committee instructed us to do this is in order to provide a certain amount of isolation or insulation for the procurement officer, and yet at the same time realizing that when a new governor comes in that he will be appointing, he or she will be appointing the commissioners, and they then appoint the individuals. This was just kind of an additional insulation. And another thing that you will find is in some places the person is referred to as central procurement officer, and in others it's chief procurement officer. That was just a difference that is going to be corrected in the next draft. There has been a request to call this person the chief procurement officer rather than the central.
Who's the request from?
Everyone that's been working on this bill calls it the chief. And it seems to indicate the head of. And since in some situations you can have a procurement officer making decisions, it seems like a better title.
Okay. As we go through this, we should change central to chief.
There are listed the various powers that this individual has, and it's basically to be in charge of everything to do with state procurement. On page 3, line 15, the Commissioner of Administration may delegate to the Commissioner of DOTPUF the ability to, or the authority to contract for the construction of highways and public works. The Commissioner of Administration may also delegate this authority to the University of Alaska for the construction.
I'd like to ask a couple questions to that point.
It's very controversial. Go ahead. Yeah.
It is the present interpretation of Consul, and perhaps the Attorney General has a letter on this too, I don't know, that we have a position here that the university doesn't have that total responsibility within the limits of the funds given them and so on. I'm just curious that we have to provide or that we may provide, but in fact the university, we're giving them what they already really truly have constitutionally.
Yes, but they don't like it. See, they want to do their own thing and not have it delegated.
But
and
you're
it's
saying
the same with DAPA. See, what can be delegated can be taken back.
Precisely. But right now, then, this attests to the position that the university does not have this right. It's not an inalienable right of the university or whatever.
Right.
And is that the opinion of your consul, those students?
Yes. That's
fine with me. I just wanted to know how we came to this conclusion.
That's been our opinion, Senator, that under existing law, the university is covered by 3705-230. They're given special recognition in Title 14 as being the purchasing officer, the purchasing authority, so that they can, their comptroller is basically in the position of the commissioner of administration under existing law. But they're required to adhere to the same statutes and provisions. What this does, it takes it down a little bit lower, a notch a little bit lower than that by saying that all power is delegated from the Department of Administration. And so all power can be given over to them.
You don't run into constitutional conflict any place here.
Well, they allege that there is one.
But you do not think so.
We do not think so, not at that level. We feel that they have control, must have control over their own property.
Once constructed.
Right. Well, when they have, but we narrowly define what is their own property. They broadly define what is their own property. But we say anytime they're dealing with state funds or the contracting with federal funds, that they can be controlled by state statutes, can be limited by state statutes, and that their individual powers only relate to that separate property of theirs, which is like land grants from the federal government, gifts and endowments to private individuals. That sort of thing is separate and apart from state control. From state executive branch control.
In capital project development. I think the debates, and you could check them because they are recorded, but and the intent and the conversations of that time, they've come secondhand to me. I was a student in that period, but still I had an interest, a real strong interest, because we're in the McCarthy era. I think they were mostly concerned about freedom of what you had in the libraries, freedom of professorial selection, the ability of the professors to teach. It's extreme right, extreme left, didn't end up dictating the university. I don't think they really were that concerned in the constitutional backup of how you built the building or how you procured.
This is Bobby at Bridge.
That's what they're really speaking to in the separation. So I think you're on good grounds.
Bill's right now joining you.
But I don't mind them pushing out into you, right?
Right.
I just wondered.
Yeah, well, they're going to take a very firm position on this.
Bobby.
Oh, they have. I can assure you that I suspect, as the Senator said, we've all heard already.
They've talked to you.
Where are you going?
I'm going out there.
Okay, what should we do now?
Okay, Bobby. Julie, are you online?
Are we broadcasting or something?
I'm online.
Okay. That's Julie in Point Hope.
Hi, Julie in Point Hope. This is Jan Fakes. How are you?
Hi.
Is there anyone else online?
Okay, everybody's gonna start dialing in because everybody's been instructed to dial in at 1:30.
Okay, who tells me when everybody's ready to go?
Okay, whenever you hear, I'll stay in there. Whenever you hear that beep tone, that means somebody gets online.
Okay.
Or whenever that beep tone, somebody hangs up. Somebody might, one of the villages might come on and say, nobody's here, so we're gonna go. Or one of the girls said, if nobody goes there, then we're not gonna even.
Okay. Julie, is there someone at Point Hope that wishes to testify?
No, no one has the right yet.
Okay, thank you. Let's just keep going.
Okay. Senator, did that answer your question?
Yes, I suspect it'll lead to a lot more input and decision making, but I just wanted to know how far he'd gone into it and retrace a little bit of my thinking. Thank you.
On the bottom of page 3, the commissioner may delegate to any other agency the authority to purchase their supplies and services. This goes along with the model procurement codes.
And
central theme, and that is centralized procurement with delegated authority out, providing a check and a balance based on criteria you have established. You have the ability to do this according to the law, and so you can do this. If at any point, though, that the commissioner determined that they were not following the law or the regulations, they could withdraw that authority.
Okay, on this, the key here also is professional services, because right now everybody can do their own thing with professional services. And this would be a delegated authority that they would have. So this is also going to be a controversial item for them.
Okay. On page 4, under D, the commissioner may not delegate the authority to adopt regulations. This is something that I wanted the committee to know, that Marcia Hubbard is already in the process of working with the Department of Law on getting some regs in line that correspond to this bill. She is taking it very seriously. The bill right now states that the regulations are due January 1, 1987. And if the bill is adopted this next session, it is Marcia's intent to have those regulations ready and working come January 1.
See, what's happened in current law is the commissioner has this authority, and she delegated it out to various agencies to adopt the regulations, and nobody did. They adopted what we refer to affectionately as P&Ps, policies and procedures. There are no regulations out there, so consequently everybody adopted their own P&Ps, and the legislature adopted theirs the day before they had their public hearing before us. So there is no backbone out there on these regulations. So this is why we said one person's got to be in charge of these critters.
Under F on the same page, states that the Board of Directors of the Alaska Railroad Corporation shall adopt procedures which are substantially equivalent to the procedures in regulations.
I'd like
regulations.
To ask questions on that one. Well, speaking to the next legislature, I understand that the separation of governments, and I think that's important. But why would we treat the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and I realize it's we're still kind of in love with a new concept, but and it's sort of a creation of this particular legislative group, too, but why would we treat them differently than the University of Alaska? What is the logic to that? I'm just curious. It seems to me like we are doing so.
The logic probably is that they have to compete with other private sector carriers and therefore have to operate on a much different schedule than a public entity, where the university is traditionally a public entity, is competing with public entities by and large. The railroad is in a traditionally private field. And
excuse me, this is Bobby, your bridge operator. Facility Jalefkosuk is now joining in the conference.
Traditionally private.
I think that's a good case, but the other argument, and it is also a case, is that the railroad does not define the Constitution, but the University of Alaska is. That would be the other approach. So we certainly have two positions here, and that one bothers me a little bit.
I agree with your, I think you're trying to say
I did state it
to a certain extent, but I think Jim explains it pretty well, in that the university should have the leeway of dealing with their own land-grant powers with a minimum interference. But when they come to the legislature for their appropriation, there's a different set of criteria that they buy into as they buy into general fund appropriations. If the university can be encouraged to really manage and develop a working endowment out of their land-grant, then I think our interference in how they allocate those funds should be substantially less than it is in general fund dollars.
But Senator, if the railroad never comes to the public for funds for capital development and so on, then that would make a better point. But if it happens to, then it puts it back in the category of the university again.
Well, if they break their deal and come back to us for dollars,
that's right.
Then
that's
you're
a good
actually
argument.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I think that ought to be part of our intent statement flowing through here or something, some transcript, if we adopt this legislation. So if you ever come back to it, we ought to say, hey, this was discussed, and if they come back for dollars, we may well believe that they should then meet certain procurement procedures that they may not have met. So we treat everything equal. That's all I'm saying. I know it's conjecture and thrown way out there, but it wouldn't hurt now to have that as part of the record so they can fall back or to be fallen back on.
What we did is we tried to be consistent with the statute as it's written now, which says the railroad shall adopt procurement procedures that are consistent with railroad industry throughout the country. And so we've got that one line in the current statute, so we felt like, okay, as long as they were essentially equivalent to these regulations and procedures, we would let them continue off and do that.
I don't mind it, but I do see the other two arguments coming into play.
Yes.
I think your point is well taken. It's just a general attitude that if you're operating on state general fund dollars, you're going to face a higher level of scrutiny with all your activities than you are if you're generating internal funds and making the decisions on those.
That's
internal
a good
funds.
Point. I don't argue that.
I think
much.
We can make the same case with the railroad and the university.
Good afternoon. We've got the village of Point Lay joining the conference.
Good afternoon. Candace at Tulisic? I'm not going to try that. Do you have someone there to testify?
From Point Lay?
Well, I'll take Point Lay. Is there someone there from Point Lay that wishes to testify?
Martha, do you have anybody there to testify or to say anything?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
How about Akasuf? Marie, do you have anybody there?
Is that the new village?
I have one person here that would like some information.
Please have them come forward to the microphone. We welcome them to the teleconferencing today. My name is Jan Fakes. I'm from Anchorage. I have Senator Rick Halford from Chugach Eagle River with me, Senator DeVries from Palmer-Wasilla area, Senator Kratula from Palmer-Wasilla area. We have Attorney General Hal Brown, and we have Jim Baldwin from the Department of Law, Tam Cook from the Department of Legislative Legal Drafting or Legal Services, and we have Elizabeth Hickerson, who's an attorney on the staff of Senator Halford and myself. So we welcome you and we'll be glad, and we have Bob Link from the Department of Administration here. Sorry, Bob, I didn't see you around the corner. What is your question?
I have no question at this time. I'm here just for information purposes only, representing the city of Akasuk. I just want to find out what this program is all about.
Oh, well, very good. Well, we welcome you. What we're doing is we have come to Point Barrow at the invitation of the mayor to hold a public hearing on a model procurement code on contracting and leasing that we hope the legislature will consider in January and adopt as the law of the land this coming legislative session. It's a very long bill. It rewrites a 1956-58 procurement law that was developed in territorial days and has become antiquated and needed a rework and redrafting. So we're conducting a work session right now on the draft of the bill. Please don't hesitate to interrupt us at any time if you do have a question. Meanwhile, we'll just continue working through our work copy here and discussing the bill.
Thank you.
Just one other comment about the Alaska Railroad. They've been quite active since the hearings have started. And, in fact, they're not pleased with this small amount of what they see as being interference with their independent rights and powers. On that same page, under Section 020, the legislature is provided for. The legislature must adopt procedures, once again, that are substantially equivalent to the procedures prescribed in this chapter, and the same provisions for the court system. As a matter of fact, the court system has a very sophisticated procurement code that they have just recently adopted after working on it for several
Didn't
months.
Did we drop those two sections out?
They're right here?
No.
We dropped
the university out. We rolled the university in, and we dropped DOTPUF out. We rolled them in.
I thought we dropped both the legislature and the courts out with regard to...
There was a last sentence in the paragraph which said, conforming specifically to the regulations written by DOA. That was what I got placed off.
Okay, so they have to conform to the law, but not the regulations.
Right.
Right. Okay, and... Then on page 4 and 5, we talk about the regulations and a whole list of what kind of regulations should be adopted. These are based on the Model Procurement Code, and probably at the top of page 6, the committee would want to strike the latter part of the last sentence. on page, on line 3, top of page 6. So three, that's very good again. On page 6, list of contractors. This was originally based on existing AS3698020. However, it's been expanded. With the feeling that we've heard from the committee people and also the agency people that they would like to have one list available for all potential bidders to be on that list. That notices would be mailed out to the people, the qualified people, depending upon the supplier services that is needed. So everyone will get notified if they're on that list.
And Senator Couture, one thing that's here for the local hire folks, which I think is an interesting thing, is you have to have evidence of a valid Alaska business license before you get on that list. So that was one of the public came in. In fact, that's IBEW suggestion. And I think that was a good one.
And also there is a provision whenever you bid, you have to list your subcontractors and they also must have evidence of an Alaska. The license is on.
Corporate income taxes and so on.
Okay. Ready? This list must be used by all agencies and also must be used by Ledge Council, the court system, and the Alaska Railroad Corporation. The attempt here was to make it uniform so that the vendors out there could go to one list. We've heard a lot of testimony from people in Fairbanks and in Anchorage that they don't know how to access the system, that they might have an in to DOT, but they didn't know how to get into regular supplies from other agencies. And this makes it a more of a tight system for vendors. If they know where they go to get on a list, and then everybody's going to use that.
Okay, the public wants this. The agencies don't like it. The university's already told us they aren't going to use the list. So the public, though, this is the one thing I think consistently in the public testimony that we've heard, is they want to be able to go to one place and get on a list, and that list gets circulated like the federal government does.
I see. I can see the public wanting to be sure they're on the list, but I can also see some problems where an agency wants to reach someone that's not on the list. And I wonder if the compromise may be that there shall be a single list, and if there is a single list, anyone going out has to have access to a list and has to bring out an RFP or whatever, go to the list, but they can also go beyond the list. So that if you get on the list, you're sure you're going to get the invitation, but it doesn't mean that you can't pick a qualified bidder that's on the list.
Under ladder section, under notice, that's provided, that they can send out, they have to send out to the list people, but they can send out to other folks.
And it's good if they can collect from outside of the list. All, any of these, because the legislature is
I think the real problem here is the ability of the Department of Administration to keep this list current and available through a computer type system. Where they can print out labels? Okay, under section 060, specifications, the committee has also heard a lot of criticism that,
How would you manage this list? Now, do you categorize this list, or how would you manage it? Because right now, we have a thousand categories. If you want to sell the station, then shoot, check off the category.
Excuse me, this is Bobby, your bridge operator. The village of Pokdolvik has now joined in the conference.
Thank you.
And the Peter available on the screen, or you can get hard copies of the screen. But you're only going to do it with a list of five people that provide the right on the screen. So it's not just a group, it's a whole bunch of things for everybody. Is it legitimate to have vendors in some way contribute to the cost of making the operator present?
I think $10 fee.
Yeah, if you want to be on the list, I don't see why they shouldn't kick in a certain amount of money.
Well, and the problem is that you better have specific authority for it in here because we tell agencies that it's generally not a good idea to charge a user fee unless there's specific statutory authority for that, which has protected the public from a lot of user fees over the years.
Well, just to hear that, you know, that would be a good thing because I can see somebody that is basically in the he's going to want to be on every list to it and look for a different judge measure for any possible list, any possible point. I mean, if in fact, if we're going to maintain this system for their benefit, we're going to have a $10 time fee per category. And then we'll get, we know that the people that were on the list are here enough to have done that. And you probably get less 35 categories, 50, 60.
Why don't we make biannual whatever the fee is? That's what we'll get your category, like you said.
It might help the system when I'm still here.
Why don't
we
grab
that? You want to put a section in there giving the authority to have a user fee?
That'd be all right. You can show it. It seems to me you can just show the finance committee. This is what you've taken in. And this is further justification for requesting this amount of funding for this purpose.
Okay, let's see if there's anyone. Yeah. Hello, Kat Tolvik. This is Point Zero Teleconferencing. Is there someone there that wishes to ask a question or to participate in a public hearing on a procurement bill? Hello, Kat Tolvik.
There's one person here at this time.
Would they like to ask us any questions or would they like to give us any comments?
Not at this time.
All right, thank you very much. Is it any time there's a question, just let us know, please. We are going through a work draft of the model procurement code. There are four state senators here, the attorney general, members of the Department of Law, and the Department of Administration. And we are literally just going through a work draft of the bill, writing it up, debating it, asking each other questions, and getting some clarification. So please interrupt us at any time. So, okay.
Any other questions or comments on the list? One problem we've heard is in the area of specification, request for proposals, any kind of written solicitation that goes out to the public. The criticism has been that they're not narrowly drawn sufficiently so that bidders spend a lot of time and money bidding on something that they are not qualified for. Whether that is true or not, that seems to be a concern out there that has been expressed. This next section provides that regulations shall be developed. The commissioner may obtain expert advice. This is and the other provisions under specifications, a combination of the Model Procurement Code and our present AS 1910-160, which is on page 7 and specifically provides that construction maintenance of highways must conform to the American Association of State Highway Officials. Supply management is just out of the Model Procurement Code. It says that the commissioner may adopt all kinds of regulations to take care of the management of supplies. Leases on page 8. This is different from the first draft. The first paragraph, paragraph A, is similar to our present AS 3705280, but it has been modified. And Tamara, help me on this. Previously, under this section, the departments had to get legislative approval for any leases. But this deletes that
And under Section B, or subparagraph B, for lease financing agreements, it's more stringent than it has been in the past and says that the legislature must specifically approve,
yeah,
not
Jim,
through an appropriation.
This is your suggestion, right. And this is the governor's bill.
This is the governor's bill.
Right. Right.
Has this changed any since last draft?
No. Well, since yes, it has. See, at the last meeting, the committee adopted the suggestion that we take out the provision in existing law and insert the governor's provision.
Right, but this is exactly the same as the governor's bill was.
It can't. It's a House bill. It's a governor's bill. Was in the House. It was amended in the House. And I haven't checked what that amendment is. But when I asked what should go in here, I was handed the House amended version. And I can't report to you how it was amended in the House, but apparently it was in a way that was agreeable to the governor.
The question I had is on A, the leases which can be approved without legislative authority.
Right.
And we discussed it a little bit before.
What that
section? We were going to put a dollar limit on that.
Well, I don't. That could
would
be
that really be infringing on the executive branch authority? Is that what we decided?
Well, the way this is drafted now, all normal leases would not be subject to legislative approval. I think you can think back and think of how many leases you've approved in the past years that you've served in the legislature. Not at all. They haven't been submitted. And so this would just recognize that reality. The way the law reads now, if any lease over $12,500 has to go through and there has to be a concurrent
resolution, so the resolution was unconstitutional. That's why we
right.
lost the whole thing.
Right. And then you go down to the B part here, and it picks up what we think that the legislature is concerned about, and that's these lease-backed financings where you get the state into a moral obligation situation without the legislature having anything to say about it. The B part would pick up all of those kinds of, without regard to dollar amount, would pick up all those transactions.
Is the 40 years on line 16
existing law? Yes. Except
existing law says that they have to be approved.
Right.
But existing law is not constitutionally enforced.
It's not followed. It's just a dead letter right now.
Okay, the question I have gets into the area, the gray area between a lease and a lease purchase. 40-year lease that doesn't have a lease purchase can be the basis of a financing plan and can, if there aren't some very specific disclaimers guaranteed by statute to be in there, be the result or result in a court case which in fact enforces the financing plan in which they built the building under. What I'm wondering about, and I thought we discussed it before, I thought we were going to add it in here, was something to the effect that the leases are subject to annual appropriation and may not contain
That's a later provision under multi-year contracts.
But well, at least in a multi-year contract, it should apply to both.
Yeah, there's a later provision in here in a later article dealing with specifically with what's known as a multi-year contract.
But a multi-year lease is the same thing.
Right.
It have the same liability. I just want to make sure it shouldn't also be in here, though.
It's covered. I think it's covered in the later section. Under the definitions of this bill, leases are treated as the purchase of supplies. I believe the word supply includes lease in the definition. So a lease would be covered by all the general terms here in our law, which is it's something that we've been doing since statehood, but other states regard this, oddly enough, as an innovation that we bring leases into our contracting law, the way we've always done business. States like Arizona have had it severed out completely from their model procurement, which is a bad thing because then you have just a free-for-all for leases. At least in the past, we've had our leases under contract law, but our contract law has been poorly defined. So there's no problem with treating a lease as a contract. So the provisions later on which deal with multi-year contracts apply to multi-year leases as well.
So I just want to make sure.
Did we pick up his language? That's just starting to trouble me. Did we put that in the multi-year contract section that you did concern?
It's 21.
I remember your concern, and I think we debated it and wondered about how we were going to do that. Yeah. Whether, isn't this one where we said we were going to have to think, you and I were going to have to work this out and see how we were going to deal with it, and we felt that we couldn't deal with it for this draft?
I don't see it in here, guys.
Yeah, Marcia and I and Bob Link were going to get together and try and come up with a solution. And we were going to wait for that November 15th meeting that all the people back in June
were
there. It doesn't meet your concern, right?
sounds like paragraph C was raised.
Right.
Yeah. It has to do with one-time capitalized expenses, right, which are amortized across the...
But that's exactly what makes a long-term lease the basis of financing, and in fact, a lease contract and a commitment to appropriate.
That's right.
If there's any provision under which we can be forced to appropriate to answer a judgment at court because we took action and allowed something, I believe it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. That's where I draw a pretty narrow line on committing future legislation.
Page 8.
Thank you.
And Senator, we're on leases, and we are debating. Right now, the paragraph A broadens existing statutes so that there isn't even anything that says they have to come back to the legislature, even though in practice they don't follow that. But paragraph B is the governor's bill that the House is working through, that the governor wished to be put in here, that says lease financing agreements must come to the legislature for approval. So wanted you to be aware of this because you felt pretty strongly about the lease section, and we're just talking about it right now.
I appreciate that, bringing it right to my attention. I'm sorry I was out for a moment.
That's all right.
I do feel strongly about it.
Senator, I thought maybe I could explain to you a little bit before we get too far along on this point what it is we propose doing, and that would be, is it page 8? Page 8, the section, page 8 there, the section you see there at the beginning on page, line 12, that A part is substantially existing law. And what we took out was the language that if you have a lease that's valued over $12,500 a year, it has to go through a legislative approval process by a concurrent resolution. You've been in the legislature for a long time, and I don't think you've ever had to approve a lease. We've never sent them. It's just never been done.
We found ourselves in extreme opposition of the administration spending money.
That's right.
Without legislative approval, and that stopped the Anchorage office from going dead flat this year.
That's right. And the B part, which begins on line 19, is a version of the governor's bill that was accepted by the House, amended slightly in the House, and is now pending in the Senate. And what we did, the Senator Zaroff, I believe, was in attendance last time. And the bill was in his committee. Permission was asked if we could put it in this bill rather than commit the faux pas of pulling the bill from his committee without his consent. So he consented to this. And this is the governor's solution to giving to the legislature the power to review and approve these lease-back financings, like the Anchorage office complex, like the Seward prison, like the skill center. And it does it in a way that's consistent with the alive voluntary decision by saying that it must be approved by law. So I think as Senator Josephson observed last time, it's the governor really tipping his hat to the legislature and saying, well, in these situations where we can create a moral obligation and can in a way significantly tie the legislature's hand, we, for these significant types of agreements, we'll go to the legislature for approval.
But I think you have a real good point.
Well, the point is the effect, not the method. And there's two ways that you can, in fact, finance the construction of a new building. You can do it with a state COP program, you can do it with a state lease person, but you can also take a state 40-year lease with no cancellation provisions and go to the bank and you can build a building without anything else from the state. And the state, in fact, may be liable for a short-term cancellation if it cancels the lease, regardless of appropriation. My point was that we should say in that section there that leases, multi-year leases, I agree with the benefit that we get by multi-year leases, not having that same builder have to compete with everyone else. But I also believe that the legislature has to maintain the right to stop that function 5 years from now, completely stop that function of government constitutionally and not pay a penalty for it, or we've committed future legislatures against the constitutional provision.
I certainly agree, because we went back to the following. During our right-of-way leasing days, and we had some very knowledgeable people here, constitutional advisors, and this is having to do with right-of-way leasing the oil pipeline, but they stated unequivocally that one of the strongest clauses of the Constitution, the Commerce Clause, as I remember it, and I'm just a layman on this thing, that contracts, state of Kansas for one, flew in the face and held. And I think the state legislature, notwithstanding our state constitution, if we don't get involved here, that contract by the administration might well hold, regardless of what we say in our state constitution. And that has worried me forever.
Well,
the thing that I want to do,
we want
to
be involved.
I don't want us to lose the benefits of multi-year contracting. And I don't want us to have to run through, I think the individual is going to finance the plan. He's going to have some protection to go to the bank with a state contract anyway. But the state needs to be able to stop that function. I don't think that individual should have to go to bid every year and therefore not build something specifically suited to the state against everyone else. But I do think that we've got to maintain the ability, particularly with the revenue going the way it is, to be able to totally stop a function and not have to buy out a building where we were teaching underwater basket weaving when we could afford it, and now we can't.
See, I'm not so sure that we could walk out of the Frontier Building.
Mm-hmm.
Right now. See, I just that worries me to death. And so there, I'd like something in here that has a jump out of the Frontier Building clause. If oil bottoms out, we aren't going to be in the Frontier Building. And there has to be a way of protecting us from that.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of ways that are already built into the law. One way that I think we could do, one thing I think we could say in here that would meet some of your fears would be to say that, just repeat in this section that, of course, any 40-year lease is subject to appropriation, to the precondition of appropriation. We could say that. We could throw it in here as well. There's another section in here which gives the department the power to, by regulation, adopt certain contract clauses. And one of them, which has not received a lot of notice yet, but is very important from our standpoint, is the power to have a termination clause in the contract which says it can be terminated at the convenience of the government. So if we sit down and look at our budget and decide we don't have money in our budget to pay for a particular lease, we can terminate that.
Without prejudice, without having to pay a tremendous amount?
Nothing. What we do is, under that clause, usually what you do is you leave the parties where they are as of the date of termination. So if we've gotten 2 months into the year, we pay them as of the two-month date. There might be other related expenses that we would have to pay for, but it's limited. You can limit yourself. You can get out by leaving the parties basically where they stand. It's a power of, it makes some people nervous because they say, well, I don't like dealing with the state then under the circumstances that they can just cut off our contract anytime they want to. But it's a well-known power that the federal government exercises. In many of our contracts, we have termination for convenience clauses. Particularly, we don't.
You got it in your royalty oil contracts.
We have it in royalty oil contracts. We have it in our professional service contracts, right. But we don't often have it in our commodities contracts or our supply contracts.
Okay, let me ask you a question. The legislature, by law, must approve the royalty oil contracts.
That's by contract.
There's
an argument about it. But what we say is that we agree by contract to submit it to the legislature. That's how we get around our constitutional worries
meaning
about
their contract.
I understand with the companies.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I understand what he's talking about. Okay, well, I was going to use that same analogy. I mean, we approved the royalty oil contracts. I didn't realize it was controversial except by the political sense of whether we approve them or not. I didn't know we were in a debate with the executive branch.
Or
well,
not.
See, to me...
Not really.
Just,
it's such a heavy area. Yeah, we agreed to avoid the debate. It's such
right.
a heavy area that the governor doesn't
okay.
want to go forward without legislative
Okay,
input.
To my constituents, a $10 million lease for rental space is more real to them and more important to them almost. They can understand it than a 50,000 barrel a day oil contract that's in the multi-millions. And so I'm wondering what the difference is. I guess I want to give one more chance to, if it's a multi-year contract and it's over $10 million, I don't know why the legislature shouldn't be approving it. So I just throw that out.
I agree.
I'm not sure that I would use exactly that kind of criteria, because if it's $10 million in its total life or in its first year.
Well, we can talk about that, but the $10 million is extremely valuable to my constituents. I mean, they think that is an enormous amount of money.
But you see, we do approve it in the first year by approving
the
budget.
Side.
So we have the control over the year that it starts. It's the multi-year facet of it.
Yes, but we don't, though. How much does the public understand about approval of a lease in the middle of the Department of Administration's budget, and they're all lumped in? When have you ever gone down the list of their leases, the buildings, who they own, you know, blah, 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 blah. The kind of scrutiny that a royalty the royalty oil contracts get is the kind that, you know, that I'm talking about. I think, you know, I'll be beat down on this issue. I just feel that the contracts deserve to be looked at and voted up or down when you're involved with that kind of money. And I don't care whether it's the term of the contract or not. Term of the contract, five. What are the leases? I'm using the Frontier Building because I know about it, not because I'm picking on it. But what's the term of that contract, Frontier Building?
That one, I think, is 10.
Just a bunch of people in DNR should have been horsewhipped.
Okay, a 10-year contract at $10 million? What's the...
It's
$59 million.
It's a lot. Big bucks.
See, I think that should come to the legislature.
Just criminal. Previous administration came close to it, in my opinion, and that's...
Well, but I'm willing to have the Department of Law tell me I'm wrong constitutionally. It seems wrong to me to commit the state, and I cannot believe that if the state next year decides to move out of the Frontier Building, that we aren't going to be in the middle of a lawsuit that you're going to argue, and we're going to have to pay them some sort of damages for that. And I agree with Rick. I for sure want the multi-language put in here, but I'm not so sure I don't want the legislature to have to approve all contracts that... If the total amount for the life of the contract is $10 million, I don't care if it's 30 years. If it's $10 million, we look at it.
Boy, I think you're meeting the test. I think you're right. If our Constitution says we are the appropriating, authorizing, then we must do that. Otherwise, it is a method of sneaking around that responsibility. I agree with you 100%.
There may be three tiers, then, of contracts.
Leases.
Of leases. There may be the annual contract that has disclaimers in it that is, although it's multi-year on its face, it's got such tight language in its disclaimers that there is, in fact, no viable potential liability on short-term cancellation. That's one contract. That contract, your separation of powers is handled because it's the appropriation for that year. And you have the second category where it may be to the legislature and the executive branch and everybody's advantage that the contract be ongoing and that there not be all these prohibitions against cancellation because the cost of money is lower and so on and so forth, but isn't the lease purchase. That, if it's of any significant size, requires legislative approval. And there may be the third category, which is the contract that has a direct tie-in to a lease purchase with or without COP financing, and that also requires the direct legislative approval. Is that where we're getting?
But I don't want the Department of Administration to sign a series of three-year contracts with the same building owners that are all $3.5 million each over the course of 15 years to get around some artificial limit that we put on that thing, too.
I agree with that. But I'm trying to... I mean, you see what I'm trying to reach?
Yeah.
But Jim, are we overstepping our authority here?
Absolutely, yes, on the top and the question in the middle.
Well, I think our view has been that any time that, in effect, you have the legislature signing off on leases that we bring to them, individual leases, you're getting into some areas that border on problems within the Constitution. If The signing and approval of leases is an executive branch function. The appropriation of money to pay for those leases is definitely the power, the real power that the legislature has in this area. If we get to where we have to submit our budgets where there are line items for each lease, there's a real fear that we'll have a problem in dealing with the landlord community because, number one, they're going to have trouble getting their finances. Yeah, they won't come to us. They'll come to you guys. And that will be painful for you.
We don't want that.
It's painful for us now because they come to us.
It will be a massive avenue of potential corruption.
Right. So our solution was to pick the area where that concerns us too. This lease financing thing is a new creative financing technique that has a lot of appeal to people, not only to the legislature but to the executive branch, because you can have your capital budget without using general funds. You can use outside investors. So Seward has discovered it twice with the skill center and with the prison. And so you can see it's kind of like a narcotic. It'll catch on if there isn't state general fund money out there. So this was the area that we thought was the area that needed legislative scrutiny. Think of the hours that you've been knotted up on Royalty Oil debating those contracts. Do you want another classification of contracts that you're going to be knotted up over debating? I think you have to look at it not only from the abuse that, that could happen from these leases that are let go, but still you have the control over the individual budget categories. We can't enter into these leases if we don't have the money. And clearly, I think it's provided in here that you can't. All of our leases, all of our multi-year contracts are subject to appropriation, so we can't bind the state by signing a 40-year contract. All we can do is bind the state 1 year at a time, or else we're going to be violating the debt problems. So what I'm saying is, I think that you got a 120-day session. You got a lot of issues before you every year. Why sever out another area that's going to require special attention when you can get it through your normal budget oversight? And why not center on these creative financing areas that I think are subject to the most abuse and can affect indirectly the state's bond rating? I think that's our, that we're saying, you know, take a bite here, but let's make sure it's something that we can chew without choking.
But you're a practical administrator. You represent what is practical, and that is very important. And I'm getting to appreciate you more as I slowly know you.
Over the last 10 years.
But,
I've seen you kicking at him.
We've been in some very many battles, some pretty vicious ones. But he's been much nicer than me. But I am really concerned.
That's because he's winning.
That's right. But the constitutional issues are nothing that we should be arbitrary about. It. If it is, in fact, the responsibility of the legislature, no matter how painful, then we should proceed. Or we should change the Constitution, we should do something. But that's my problem. And it has always been. We've had these arguments before. I think it is very... Your statement... Well-intentioned people, you're absolutely right. I mean, except if it is our responsibility, I don't want to go around backdooring us.
Yeah.
Well, rather than get into the approval mode, my proposal was that we simply require that the multi-year contract be done in such a way that there is a specific provision that says there is no penalty for short-term cancellation. Meaning, I don't mean short-term, I mean cancellation year to year for lack of appropriation. Not your language, which was cancellation of government convenience.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, well, you know what they do to us when we get into these deals? They
jack the price.
Well, yeah, they jack the price, but they also try to get us to accept non-substitution clauses where if we walk on the lease, we can't do that function anymore.
Right.
Well, we keep telling them, hey, we're not going to do that. So that's against public policy. But they say, well, that's the only way you're going to sell your certificates. So they try to go outside of the appropriation limitation.
But basically, they're trying to bind us through political means to what they can't constitutionally bind us to do. They're trying to bind an appropriation. They're trying to bind and limit the options of a future legislature, which is clearly against the intent of the Constitution, even if there's some way they can weasel it through the weave.
Right.
Jay?
As you know, your friends that are the citizens participants in procurement, facility procurement, leasing, building procurement, they've been studying and they had a report to the governor, and I met with them in this particular report stage. And they're not into any of the other aspects that this bill is, but they're in that. And they have strong recommendations that I think ought to be incorporated, are concerned, or at least they ought to get their recommendations before we, you know, I know we want a legislative system, but I think we ought to do it during this period. We ought to have those available to cover this particular area.
It's under the lease financing situation,
yeah.
And it's basically
yeah.
what's here,
so
that the legislature has to approve it.
Yeah.
But the question that Senator Curtula and I feel is that if there's a lease out there, a multi-term lease of X amount of dollars for the life of the lease, trouble or not, I think it's our responsibility to say yes or no on that critter.
I think we'll pay someplace.
Well, see, what I was saying is avoid doing it then. Put the disclaimer in so that you don't get the liability. And
but, you know, if you put it
that way,
it's going
to take a combination of both of those things. In effect, you're going to end up with a three-tiered system.
Okay, let's say that I'm a developer out there, or I'm a commercial renter, and I have lease space, and you've got that clause in there, then the price is going to go up. Would the price go up more if the person knew that they could get a multi-year lease and could count on a 10-year lease if the legislature just approves it? Would the price be more reasonable? I'm just asking the question.
My inclination is that it would. And that's
why the conservative banker would make it more reasonable.
Right.
That's why I said three tiers. One is the annual lease, which we don't want to get in the middle of, that has all the disclaimers in it. So it's truly an annual lease.
Okay.
The second one is the multi-year lease, where it's not a lease purchase, but it's still a lease, but it's multi-year, and there's some real question as to whether we have liability beyond. Now, that still flies in the face of the Constitution, because we're still committing another legislature,
right?
And the third one is the COP financing.
Well, maybe we can't approve a lease of the executive branch, a 10-year lease at $10 million, because of the committing one legislature to another.
That's a good point to be carefully researched.
Ted?
I was just sitting here wondering what a legislative approval of a lease would actually amount to. Because...
I mean,
it's just like the royalty oil deal. It's a half a paragraph, you know, half a page, saying a legislature approves the lease of Joe Schmo to 43,000 square feet at $1.43.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's two resolutions.
Yeah.
Or a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Concurrent resolution. That means both bodies had to pass it, but it's pretty still
right.
A pretty simple.
So
in the old days, you could voice vote it even.
Sure. Basically, what you're saying is we promise that we're going to keep appropriating. But is there any legal teeth in that? What if the next legislature doesn't
Very
want to
good
vote
point.
For that?
Very good point. They may have no more reason to believe that that has more legal teeth than the governor signing off on something. I agree with that. We just insisted, at least, in all the old forms, that the legislature had made some form of commitment.
At some time.
At some time.
Right.
And remember Victor's big argument about putting the money into buying the land was that kind of a commitment.
Right.
That never was. I mean, yeah, I think... buying the footings and the foundations for it would have been, but not just the land purchase. There's a fine point there. But anyway, going back to that, that was always our position. And now that I'm recollecting, I think Jan well understands it. We can't bind, but for convenience, there is a bind, so we give it a little bit of direction by saying the previous legislature did agree to do this. Still too bad, you could say. I know that.
But what really determines it, I would think, and I wish somebody that more
would be back only when your leases are possible, if it were
is what the court's going to say when you go to court. What
yes.
is what is it,
yes.
a reasonable court going to say when you fail to appropriate and you had a 10-year contract? Is, in fact, contract law supreme to the state constitution in an area that's that?
I bet it's going to say that.
And if it is... It
seems logical that they would.
Okay, well, if it is... And but that's my feeling too. But then it is clear, whether we like it or not, that we cannot do it. If we create a contract knowingly that binds future legislatures, we are violating the clear intent and the direct statement of the Constitution.
This may take a constitutional amendment to be practical.
Can I make a suggestion? Mm-hmm. I think I understand what each of you are getting at, and there is a question here is the best way to accomplish that and still be constitutional. How about if we report back to you on the 22nd, which is our next meeting of procurement?
Where are we going to be on the 22nd?
Anchorage.
I horrify you. Happily, both have to be speaking someplace in order to make it.
Okay, Senator, I'm sure this issue will be
purposes.
Alive and well for,
yeah.
And try and come up with a variety of ways to accomplish the same thing and let you pick and choose from it.
Okay, let's go on to Article 2.
Okay, Article 2 gets into the bidding types. The preferred method, the rule, is competitive sealed bidding. Everything else is more or less an exception and requires written justification in order for it to be valid. Now, there are a list of items under B, and this is from present statute AS 3705-230, for which competitive seal bidding is not required, and it's basically because of the nature of the price being close to being fixed, except for professional services. It's not saying that you cannot use competitive seal bidding for professional services, but it's not required, since generally speaking, professional services are acquired through competitive seal proposals or other forms of RFPs, types of solicitations. Under the invitation to bid,
Number one on line 7, when you talk about food, does that include like all the food for all the institutions? So that is not required to be competitively bid.
Bob, why don't you answer?
Whereabouts are we?
Page 9, line 7.
Okay, thank you.
Right now, we treat this paragraph as the equivalent of the bid waiver type of process. Somebody would have to come up for a reason why some particular type of food would be have to be procured under some particular usual service. Right now, all the food is bid.
Well, I've read that a couple times.
Except you don't buy anything from Alaska that I know of.
Alaska, that
well, the way to strengthen that may be to require a finding of fact by the commission already.
Say it again, Senator.
The way to strengthen that provision may be to require a finding of fact by the commissioner in writing in order to
support it by written determination and after judgment.
You don't change the abuse, but you or the potential for abuse, but you do by the fact that somebody got their name on a line and said, this is why. They have a good reason. That's
extra step. Right, yeah. They have to take that extra step. And that's how this bill works all the way through. Mm-hmm. Written determination. Somebody's got to put their name right on the line if they're going to procure in any other way than competitive sale bid. Right. The ITB at the bottom of page 9 is based on the Model Procurement Code's provision and basically includes information that should be included in these invitations to bid. A date by which the bid must be received. This has received quite a bit of criticism, so we included that there. Purchase description, the evaluation, any subcontractors, valid Alaska business license for contractors and for subcontractors. Bid security is based on the Model Procurement Code and requires that a bond may be required for not only construction but also supplies. It states that the commissioner can set by reg what level that anything above that point must be required, bid security must be required, but this section also says that this can be waived. We've heard from people, particularly minority business enterprises, that they cannot come up with the bond or security that has been required previously, or they fear that. But all of this would have to be done according to the regulations. Public notice. We have beefed this up. This is based on the Model Procurement Code as well as the existing AS 3705230. It says that the procurement officer shall give at least 21 days of notice before the date of opening the bid. This can be shortened, but it has to be determined in writing. My concern here was that on RFPs, presently, I believe they have, it's a 30-day limit right now. Is that right, Bob?
30 days from the date of signing the contract.
Versus opening.
Anywhere down to zero. Right.
That's right. Arizona has 21 days. I think that the railroad said 28 days, 30 days was too long, 28 days would be okay. 21 seemed to be a number that a lot of states utilize. Notice has to be mailed to all active prospective contractors known to the procurement officer, including those on the list that are maintained. There are other means of notice that may be used, such as publication in newspaper, posting in public places, and publication in the Alaska Administrative Journal. It was a concern of the Department of Administration that advertising often is very expensive, and they've already mailed out to a number of people on the list. So what is required here, and this adds to the importance of the bidders list, is that notice be given to all of those people in the qualified area, plus any other reasonable type of notice that seems to be necessary. This notice provision is also for the RFPs, not just for the ITBs. We have the same provision.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
For number 3, the publication in the Alaska Administrative Journal, didn't we go to a weekly one? So why would it not be practical? Me, that would not be one week. But it would be automatically going in. Have you had previous discussion on that?
It is required by the statute.
The journal requires it.
I think that should maybe be changed. You know, that's just my feeling about
publication has to be in there, I believe, by law. Something to check anyway.
There's all something about the authority regulations offers to it.
And I thought we had vetoed that budget this last year to make it weekly so you wouldn't have the long time limit.
Well, I remember it being a debate about eliminating the budget totally and not that it was supposed to be a one-year trial run and to see if it would pay for itself.
Nobody was buying it.
Nobody's buying it. So the debate I remember was to eliminate it completely, and it was a special project of the senator, and it was given another year's life.
Well, everybody's getting it.
Or otherwise, you charge extra user fees, a portion of which will go to perpetuation of the system.
I've got a question on the back a little bit. Notice shall be mailed to all active prospective contractors known to the procurement office. Now, we're putting a, you know, and then it goes on to including the list. The list is easy because it's a document. The question I have is that if three people at a meeting stand up and tell the procurement officer, I want to be notified for this, and can go back to court a month later and say they didn't get notified, is it a grievance because the procurement officer at the meeting didn't have somewhere there that got the right address?
Well, my quick answer to that is, at the time they want to be notified, you're in the form of telling them where to go get on the list, and that's the sure way for them to be.
That's not what this is.
About the list,
well, that's
yes,
the right. Notice shall be mailed to all active. Okay, the qualifier.
No, it doesn't say anything
about
the list.
It doesn't. Active, prospective contractor. Right. Known to the procurement office. And then it goes including those on the list. Well, the list is obvious, but we're putting a liability on the state potentially for whatever the court's going to find known to the procurement office.
Why don't we just put those notes to be mailed to all those on the appropriate list maintained under 36?
And maybe, and maybe provided to anyone else who's shown interest. But if the shall.
I think you can add the language by the reading on the
It's just the wording is my only problem that I thought
it's
you might
known
pick up.
To the procurement officer you
okay.
don't like.
Right.
Senator, the reason that was included is because of the situation where we may have some very unique supply that is needed. Or we wouldn't have anybody on the list that could qualify.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe there's one company in the world.
Like your fish radar.
Right.
That's the first part of the process.
On the outreach side, I have no problem with it. I'm just looking at potential liability in a protest. Someone who lost an opportunity, and in fact can bring two people in there and stand up in front of the judge and say, I witnessed him telling the procurement officer on X date at X time in front of a meeting of 37 other people that they said they wanted to know on the next chance of this particular thing, and we're qualified. Thanks.
You guys are the legal, because even Attorney General Brown says this could be a legal question. Bid opening. This is based on the Model Procurement Code as well as the Arizona Code and requires that bids be opened in public, witnessed, and that the information be available. Everyone that has presented testimony to the committee, with the exception of the Alaska Railroad, presently opens all their bids in public and that information is available for public inspection. The Alaska Railroad says that they don't have to do it because they're quasi-public-private and that this would interfere with their ability to get the best price.
Okay, the Alaska Railroad, as of last week, is going to the board of directors and ask them to change their procedures to allow for public opening of all bids.
We have not a tremendous amount of money, a significant amount of bids every year, which can't be have the above information recorded in a real time fashion. I think of groceries where you have 10 or 15 bidders and 500 line items or something like that. The person may take a week to do that. And this says you have to do it to have the stuff information available on the open. It may take the person that long to get all the information down in the abstract.
I don't understand how this is done, but is it possible just to retain a copy of the bid document itself, which becomes part of the public record?
Oh, we do the abstract. And we take all the things, list all the people, show all the bids, but sometimes it's not available at the bid opening. It's not available for several days because of the volume and the work it takes.
Yeah, but why can't you have copies of the bids available? I think that's what you're saying.
We're talking about two different things.
Well,
the abstract is usually prepared with information that you get from the bid opening.
Right.
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 This is a document that sets out the bids and compares,
right,
lists the merchants.
But you can take care of that, the amount of each bid and other relevant information that is specified by regulation. That's what A says, together with the name of each bidder shall be recorded. And then B says that the information recorded under A has to be available. By your own regulations, you can limit the volume of information that has to be there.
Okay. The only thing, if we left off at the bid opening, we'd still be providing information for public information, but there wouldn't be the requirement of providing this long list of stuff at the time the bid opens.
Promptly?
I don't know. I got a bid sitting down in my office, and, you know, which has the stack of bids is this big. You know, it's going to take the guy a week to read them all, let alone record the information. We want to give that information to the people because they want to use it. They want to find out what other people bid. You know, so we want to give it to them, and we do that now.